Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound.
How does anyone do anything when you understand the fleeting nature of existence?
The clip you just heard was actor Ted Danson from the TV show The Good Place, which recently wrapped up its run after four seasons on NBC. The Good Place was a unicorn of a TV show, a comedy, but one that explored deep philosophical issues of life and death and what it means to be human. It's probably the only show in history to hire philosophy advisors, and one of them is today's guest, Todd May, a philosophy professor at Clemson. If you watched the show, you might have seen him in a brief scene in the final episode. We talk about The Good Place today, but we start with a discussion of philosophy and ethics as it relates to the coronavirus. How should we live our lives in these strange times? Todd May has some thoughts about that. Here's our conversation. Todd May, maybe a broad-based question to start. What are some things that have happened during the coronavirus that have brought to the forefront some of the philosophical issues that you've been thinking about your whole career?
Well, actually, I think one of them is really simple, and it's pervasive. And it hinges on the idea of staying at home as a matter of keeping social distance. So if we're going to stay at home, it isn't simply for our own health, Tommy, right? It's also for the health of other people. That's to say, we feel like we have an ethical obligation to other people not to expose them to COVID-19. And so we stay away from them. We stay at home in order to do that. And this isn't just people we know, right? These are strangers. So what I think our reaction to COVID-19, or at least the reaction of most of us, has brought out is that we feel some sense of ethical obligation to others in cases in which we might bring real harm to them. Now, that's got broader implications, which I don't think everybody has thought about that much. But surely that ethical component is central to what's going on right now.
Well, talk about those broader implications. What are you thinking about there?
Well, think of it this way, Tommy. If we feel as though in our everyday actions, we're going to bring harm to others, which is why we stay in relative to COVID-19, if that's what we feel, then it seems that we're somehow committed to the idea that if our everyday actions are going to bring great harm to others, we should really try to avoid them if we can. Now, we can't always. We live in a complicated world. But at least we should reflect on the kinds of harms our everyday actions might have for others and try to avoid them to the extent that we can. That's where I think we begin to see wider obligations. And so I think the simple commitment to staying at home in order to keep others safe, has a set of what philosophers call entailments, right, that bring us into a much wider ethical territory.
Well, I know, as I'm sure you know, there's beginning to be some pushback to that idea of staying at home. And I think some people have gone so far as to say that there's an acceptable risk. If you lose X number of lives, the freedoms that the rest of us gain and being able to live normally and do the things we normally do and to do things like go back to work and make a living again, that's worth it. Now, is that something that has its underpinnings in maybe historical philosophical debates?
It does, actually. ethical theory of utilitarianism, right? The idea is that the good of your action should sufficiently outweigh the bad of your action in order to justify it. And I think there's a kind of utilitarianism going on in some of the pushback to return to work. But I'm leery about it. And I'll give you an example, not from the coronavirus, but from the philosophical literature. Tommy, suppose that you were living in a small town. You're the sheriff, and you're living in a small town. And in that small town, somebody gets murdered. You don't know who the murderer is, but the townspeople decide that this one guy is the murderer. You don't know who the murderer is, but you know that this guy is not the murderer. You've got incontrovertible evidence that this is not the murder. But here's also
that sounds like the setup for a lot of movies I've seen.
Right. Well, this is right, and this, but the ending might be a little bit different here. Right, if you don't allow the townspeople to lynch this innocent person, there's going to be a riot, and say 10 other innocent people are going to be killed. So, is it okay to let them lynch the guy? Okay. Most people are going to say no, although you cause more good because you've got 10 innocent people on one side and one innocent guy on the other. You cause more good if you allow them to lynch. So it isn't just a matter of how much utility or how much good, right, versus how much bad, right? It's also the justness of who you're going to expose and who you're going to put at risk. And one of the things that's come out is is that the African-American community has been put at much greater risk with the coronavirus, right, than, say, established middle class and white communities. So it isn't simply a matter of lives and lives. It's also a matter, right, of the kinds of justice that's involved in opening up versus keeping ourselves at home or keeping social distance for a while longer.
That sounds like it's sort of a twist on the classic trolley problem, right? Except in this one, you kind of know who the people are instead of it just being sort of random generic people.
Yeah, but and well, of course, the trolley problem is interesting as well, because in the trolley problem, if you've got five people.
Explain what it is really quick, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I figured I'll do. So on the traditional trolley problem, right, if you've got five people working on a track and there's a trolley coming and you could see that it's going to run over those five people, but you're standing near a switch, what you can do is you can pull the switch. It's going to veer off to another track. And when it veers off to that other track, it's going to kill one innocent person. So the question is that okay? Now, most people are going to go with the utilitarian on that. Say, yeah, it's okay. You can throw the switch. It can go off onto the other track. But now, right, switch this up a little bit. Suppose you have five people in a hospital, each of which is dying from a different organ failure. And there's an innocent guy, let's say it's a janitor working at the hospital, right? Is it okay to take the janitor, kill him, carve him up, right, and give his organs to each of these five people so they'll survive? Nobody says that's okay. Now, the worry in the trolley problem is what's the difference between the first trolley issue and the second, which is sometimes called surgeon case. But one of the things that's clear is that we're not going to answer in a utilitarian way in both cases, because if we answer in a utilitarian way in both cases, then it's okay to, in the surgeon case, to cut up the janitor.
Is there any particular philosopher who you wish was alive to witness all this and speak about it?
Oh, that's a great question. I suppose, Tommy, that although I have some ambivalences about his philosophy, I might want to reach back to Aristotle. And the reason I want to reach back to Aristotle is that Aristotle talked about being virtuous, developing certain ways of being that would allow us to move forward and be, I'm going to just use the term, he wouldn't use the term, fully human. Right? And Aristotle, as far as I know, right, never wrote anything about being in a situation of plague. So I do wonder, I'd love to sit down and ask him, okay, now that we're in a situation of plague, what kinds of virtues should we be developing, right, in order to live in the way we need to with one another?
Well, let me reverse engineer it and maybe put it on you. I like the way you phrase that. What sort of virtues should we have been developing all this time to make us more equipped to handle something like this?
The way I would put it is this. I think a certain reflective quality would be good. Now Tommy, if it's okay, can I talk historically here for a minute about the trajectory that led us to where we are?
You mentioned Aristotle, so I think it's okay to talk historically, yes.
Well, I don't want to do the sweep of human history since the ancient Greeks. I'm thinking the last 40 years will do.
Yeah, that's fair.
We live, or we have lived, at least since, say, 1979, 1980, you know, Reagan and Thatcher, in a period that's often called neoliberalism. Right? And neoliberalism really focuses on people's taking responsibility for themselves, but not for one another. Right? In the preceding period, the welfare state, there was some general agreement, right, that we live in a community and that we have as our one of our tasks, right, to contribute to the common good. One of the things about the neoliberal period is it's very individualist. And being individualist in the way that it is, we're told to be self-reliant, right, and we're not encouraged to think of ourselves as members of a larger social, political, ethical community. And I think one of the things that's gotten lost in all this is some reflective awareness of solidarity we might have to others, of obligations we might have to others. And so in thinking about this, right, one of the things that comes to mind for me is that a virtue that we have lost, not all of us, but certainly a virtue that we've been discouraged, right, to cultivate, is the virtue of some reflective awareness of ourselves as being members of a community. Right? And I think that had that been there, right, I think we would be seeing less of the pushback we see now, and we see more of the leaping to help one another. Now, Tommy, having said that, I'm not saying, right, that people are all being selfish. In fact, I think this has brought out a lot of good in people and a lot of solidarity. But I think going into this crisis with a more robust sense of, right, of our own ethical relationships to the larger community would have been helpful for us. That would have been a virtue I would have liked to see.
And isn't that sort of the American dilemma in a nutshell, is that we are built as a collective group of states, a collective group of people who have these kind of common goals and all that sort of thing. But we're also constructed with these very precisely spelled out freedoms that are intended to make us individuals, and that our economy is set up to sort of become the best you can be as an individual basis. I mean, that's sort of an inherent conflict in the way America is set up.
I think that's right. I remember once listening to an interview with a Norwegian who said, you know, one of the fundamental differences between the Scandinavian countries and, say, the U.S. is that the Scandinavian countries are obligation-based and the U.S. is rights-based. That's to say, the U.S. is about, right, what is in it for me, right? And in the Scandinavian countries, a much more fundamental question for them is, what do I owe to the community, right? Now, as you say, Tommy, these are not entirely exclusive, but it's surely the case that in America, we've tilted toward the more individualist and rights-based side, right? And in that tilt, I think sometimes the community appears more in shadow than it might.
I want to ask about your thoughts on how all this has affected our sense of mortality. I know this is something you wrote a whole book about and have thought about quite a bit. These moments when our sense of mortality may be heightened, you know, when all of us at one level or another are at risk, even though we're at risk every day of getting hit by a bus or something, but this seems to focus our ideas of mortality even more. Does the philosophy of mortality, or your thoughts on it, do you see people emphasizing those things anymore sort of in the culture?
In an anecdotal way, yes. Tommy, was it Samuel Johnson that said, nothing focuses the mind like the prospect of a hanging?
Right.
And I think in some sense, right, we're all in the back of our minds thinking about this prospect of a hanging. So I think, at least among the people that I've spoken with, this has become more thematic. Right? For most of us, the thought of death, we push it during most of our lives, Tommy. Right, we push it away because for most of us, in any given moment, right, the likelihood of our dying is fairly remote. Right? But there are, I think, even periods of our lives where we start to think more about our mortality. I remember a teacher of mine once said that if you think of your life as crossing from one bank of a lake to another. There's a point at which you begin to see the far shore more clearly than the shore you set out from. And at that point, you start to think. That's what's sometimes called the midlife crisis. Right? I think in some sense, we're all looking and wondering how close that far shore is, because it can be within weeks for some of us, depending on our own vulnerabilities and depending on who we're among. So I think this has come out in the form of a bit of a free-floating anxiety, but also, Tommy, I think an anxiety for others. It's our own death, but also the death of people that we care about, that I think is becoming more salient for many of us. People that we know that are older or more vulnerable. So I have grown kids. I'm not sure what you call kids when they have them, but I have offspring, adult offspring, right? And those adult offspring, right, are checking in with us because, we're in fairly good shape, but we're a little bit older. And so I think the issue of thinking about one's death with COVID-19 has come to the fore more. But I think perhaps as much or even more, the thought about the death of people we care about has become something that's more salient for many of us.
So let me go back and kind of reframe the question I asked earlier in terms of what you just said about death. What are some of the things that we ought to be thinking about when it comes to mortality, especially when the prospect of it seems closer than normal, I guess?
Yeah, this is an unusual situation, Tommy, isn't it? Because if you'd asked me that question under what we would generally call normal circumstances, I would answer that very differently from the way I'm going to answer it now. Under normal circumstances, right, the question of our death is the question that we ask, or that we ought to ask ourselves, okay, what do I want out of my life? What's important in my life? And we know that people who go through near-death experiences often will begin to reflect on that in a more rigorous way than they had before. Now, how long that reflection lasts and what lessons that has for their life for the long term, that's a different issue. That's an issue that I think involves not simply coming to an insight, but habituating yourself, right, to act in accordance with that insight and not just having it momentarily. But Tommy, this is a different situation, isn't it? Right? Because the deaths that we are worried about here are not deaths that might happen in the longer-term future around which we can design our lives, but deaths that might be more imminent, I guess is the word I'm looking for. So now we've got to ask that question, at least in this period of time, in a different way, right? It's not a question of how should my life unfold in the years to come, but a question of what do I want to think about and do now, given, right, that me or that those around me, right, might in the near future die. Now, that I think presses a certain urgency on, and I suspect, Tommy, that one of the places that question will lead, or one of the answers that question will lead to, would be forming tighter and more intimate connections with people that we care about. I suspect that one of the things that's been brought out, although it hasn't been brought out in terms of mortality, but in terms of the way we behave, is this urgency to find and connect with people that we might not have connected with or connected with as often before, right? I mean, I know as things start to shut down, I grew up in New York. I have friends in New York. I have friends in California, people in Chicago. And one of the things that I started to do was think about how will I reach them? I should have Zoom meetings with them. I should be talking with them, right? Now, this is it's not simply a matter of checking in. I think it's that too. But it's also a matter of not taking for granted that we're all going to be there. And I think that in the face of death surrounding us, right, we get thrown back on ourselves. And even if we're not reflecting on it in terms of death, we're still thinking about what's important. And what for many of us emerges as the most important thing, or at least centrally important, is our connections with others. And so we quit taking those for granted. We cultivate them, right, in a more studious way.
When we come back, Todd May talks about working on The Good Place and what it was like to turn from a philosopher into an actor. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
If you're like me, these days you would love to be able to just get away. Well, there's a way to do that without ever leaving your house. You can listen to Away Message, the award-winning podcast from our friends at Our State Magazine. Jeremy Markovich, the host of Away Message, takes us all over North Carolina to see what he can find in hard-to-find places. This season follows hikers who are trying to walk the entire length of the state on the 1,175-mile Mountains to Sea Trail. This is the fourth season of Away Message, and I highly recommend every season. You can find all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get podcasts. They're also available at ourstate.com/podcast. And now, back to our conversation with Todd May. I want to ask about your time on The Good Place, or your time advising The Good Place, I guess. How did that happen to begin with? Did you just get a call out of the blue?
This is another bit of good luck, Tommy. Here's what happened. One of the writers, Dan Schofield, read my book on death. I don't know where he got it, maybe in a bookshop, but he read my book on death, and he recommended it to Mike Scher. And Mike read it. The story that Mike tells is that he was reading it, and you have to picture it here, Tommy. It's a dull gray book with a black raven on the cover, and all it says is death, right, and my name. So his wife's crawling into bed and seeing him read this book, and apparently what she said was, "I'm not sure this marriage is going to survive the show." But apparently it did, and is thriving. But after he read it, he emailed me and said, and remember the subject line of the email was question from a TV producer. He told me who he was, told me the shows that he had worked on, Brooklyn 99, Saturday Night Live, Parks and Rec, and asked me if I'd be willing to talk a little bit on the phone about the show. Well, he seemed like such an interesting guy. I said, "Hey, why don't we just Skype together?" And we Skyped, and our first time we Skyped, we Skyped for like 2 hours. And then I want to say this without any spoilers. I was about a week before the shooting of the final episode. I got an email asking if I wanted to do a cameo. Let me be clear. There was another philosophical advisor as well, Pamela Hieronymi from UCLA, and so they offered us both cameos. So in the last episode, there's a cameo of us.
And I know in academia, there's often some worry and some deep skepticism about how the ideas of the academy might get translated into things for a mass audience. And I'm wondering sort of what your level of skepticism was ahead of time that these deeply philosophical ideas that can sometimes get way out in the weeds would be translated for a network TV series.
Yeah, okay. So Tommy, the term popularizer is sometimes used with a sneer. Right, that this, you know, he's not a real philosopher, he's a popularizer. I have never accepted that. I've always thought that much of what's done in philosophy can be done in ways that any reflective person can understand what's being said and can engage with it. Now, Tommy, I want to be clear here. I'm not saying, right, that there aren't technical problems in philosophy. There are technical problems in philosophy that you need a technical language to solve. But there are a whole lot fewer of them than you would think if you're just reading the philosophical literature. So I have long thought that much of what is done in philosophy, including many of its twists and turns, can be offered to people in a way that they can understand. It just takes a while, not simply to think through the issue, but to think through how what the best way is to say it. And Tom, if I could just speak from my own history for a minute, I came by this naturally. When I went to graduate school, I was reading philosophy and I was seeing people discussing it, and I didn't understand what they were saying. And I thought, the only way I'm going to understand what all these people are saying is if I translate it out of this stuff into words that I understand. So I made that my project, just for my own sanity and ability to try to grasp the material. And once I had it, I thought, well, okay, why don't I just keep doing this? And so what I've tried to do, even in the stuff that I write that's more, to more for philosophers, I guess, is to say things in as clear a way as I can.
I don't know how to ask this without giving away much, so let me try to think about how carefully to ask this. Does the way The Good Place ended, without spoiling how it ended, does it track with the way that you sort of see the world?
Yes. I'm going to say something, and this will give, I guess, some of your listeners fair warning. The way The Good Place ended is very close to discussions that I had in my death book. Then these are discussions that I had with Mike about life, death, and meaning. I remember at one point saying to Mike, I found this remarkable convergence in the way that this ended and the stuff that I was trying to talk about in my book on death. And his response was, yeah, that's not an accident. Those discussions that we had and the thought around the book led him to sort of think in terms which brought that stunningly beautiful final episode. Now, having said that, Tommy, I want to be careful here because I don't want to take credit for that final episode. That final episode was something that Mike wrote, that the actors did, that was brought forward in a way so much more deeply personal than I could ever make it in any of my writing. So really what appeared in that last episode were some themes that I had written, but taken up by the writers and the actors in a way to make them real and vital and urgent in a way as I watched it, I could never have imagined.
In all this work that you did with The Good Place and being having a cameo and all that, what was the most Hollywood thing that happened to you?
Oh, the most Hollywood thing. Okay, now, Tommy, give me a clue here, right, in terms of the Hollywood thing.
Well, I think, what was the kind of thing that a normal person, it might never happen to them, but it happened to you because you were connected with this TV show.
Got it. It's hands down, it's the cameo. I have to say that in doing that cameo, I learned even more respect for actors than I had. Tommy, I'm the kind of person that you put me in front of 200 people, give me a topic, give me 20 seconds, and I'll start talking about it, and I'm comfortable. But you give me two lines that I have to memorize, right? One of which, by the way, I wrote, right? Two lines that I have to memorize and then say as though they were spontaneous, and I was freaking out, right? It was all I could do to figure out how to be spontaneous with two lines I was supposed to memorize. So I developed a new respect for actors. In addition to that, it was just, I'd been with the writers, but it was great to meet the actors. And they were all so welcoming. What I'd heard about Ted Danson was, you know, reputation, nicest guy in Hollywood. So I'm standing around the set with the other philosophical advisor, Pamela Hieronymy. And he comes up to us and introduces himself, said, I haven't met you guys before. I'm Ted Danson. And, you know, of course, part of me is thinking, yeah, I kind of know that, right? But it's really cool that you came up to us, right, and introduced yourself. And I will say this, too, about Will Harper, the Chidi character, because as I was sitting quietly freaking out about these two lines I had to be able to say as though they were spontaneous, Will came up to me and he said, how are you feeling? And I said, I'm petrified. And he said that, he says, they're going to do like a dozen takes, right? So just screw up a couple of them, right? And one of the takes, one of the early takes, he screwed up. And I think he did it for my benefit, right? He screwed up and said, you got to do it again.
And I understand that you and Mike Schur, who created The Good Place, and as well as other shows, are working on a book together?
Yes. Mike's writing a book. The working title is How to Be Good, A Definitive Guide for Exactly What to Do in Every Possible Situation.
Well, that seems to be a slim volume.
Oh, yeah. No, we're going to do it. It's probably novella size. He's the writer. What's happening is he's writing and I'm reading. I'm reading, editing, suggesting, correcting at points. But he's going to, you know, it's essentially very close to what was happening with The Good Place, which is that the text comes from them. In this case, the text comes from him. And then I read the text and we go back and forth and see how to make this something that's going to be, you know, the kind of thing where there won't be confusions that need to be, where philosophers won't say, oh, you made a mistake doing this, that, or the other thing. And I have to say, I've read about a third of it so far. And there's not going to be a book on the market like it. I mean, he's hysterically funny. And he's not just hysterically funny because he's telling jokes. He's hysterically funny as he's doing the philosophy. It's the most fun I've ever had doing philosophy.
So this podcast is at least theoretically based in the South, and it's, you know, for and by Southerners or people who've come to live in the South. And so I can't get away from this without asking a couple of questions about Clemson. And you've been at Clemson how long now?
30 years.
30 years.
Yeah, half my life.
I went to University of Georgia, two big football powers, often big rivals over the years. I am a huge college football fan, but over the years, it's become more and more difficult to ethically and morally justify my love for college football. And I'm wondering, as a professor at a place where college football is a very big deal, I wonder if you are having any of the same moral and ethical dilemmas.
This is a really good question. Let me give one caveat here. I've never been a huge college football fan. I grew up in New York. I was a big fan of the New York Knicks. I don't know if you know the New York Knicks, but they used to be a professional basketball team.
I hear back in the 70s, right?
It's been a long time, Tommy. Yeah, we're going to win another one any day now. So I've never been a huge fan of college football. I mean, you can get kind of caught up in it, but at Clemson, in some of the philosophy classes, this issue will come up. There's a certain self-selection here, Tommy, because the people who are going to show up at a philosophy class are more likely to be thinking about that as an ethical issue.
You know, as you said, you grew up in New York, but you've lived in South Carolina now for quite a long time. Do you feel like there's a Southern philosophy of sorts that maybe is different from other places in this country? You know, I think we like to think there is, those of us who grew up here, but do you feel like, having come in from outside, that there really is a sort of philosophical difference in the way we think?
I feel like I want to turn this back your way before I take that next step and say, you said something about it. You think there might be a different kind of philosophy. Could you tell me a bit about what you're seeing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that certainly there's the thought in many Southerners' heads is that we're maybe more independently organized in other parts of the country. And in terms of what you said earlier about the collective versus the individual, I think the individual idea here is especially strong. I think there are philosophies in terms of, and I'm not sure whether this even qualifies as philosophy, in my mind it does, the idea of fighting rather than trying to find more calm solutions to things, that we are more inclined to get our danders up maybe than the rest of the country. But at the same time, we have this idea of ourselves as being more polite and more gracious and more welcoming. And I think those things are obviously have some internal conflicts. And so I wonder whether any of those things are actually true, and if they are, whether they add up to anything in particular.
Good. Yeah, this is really helpful. So let me take the last two things, the fighting and the politeness, right? It's surely the case that in the South, there's more nearly what's often called an honor culture, where one's honor can be disrespected and that becomes sometimes a cause for violence. Yeah, that's much more clear to me living here than, say, in New York. In New York, you could go a good distance sort of shouting back and forth or whatever without ever feeling that there was going to be violence that was going to result from that. So there is that. And there is, I think, also a more surface politeness. And I the way I would put it is that that in the South, it's much easier to become friendly with someone, much more difficult to get past the surface.
Something like the coronavirus makes the questions more urgent. But in the end, the questions are really the same. What do we owe each other? How do we do good in the world? What gives our lives meaning? These are the ideas that Todd May thinks about for a living. The reason philosophers have jobs, I guess, is that most of us aren't very philosophical, at least most of the time. It could take a jolt as big as a pandemic to get us to think about why we're here, what purpose we serve, and how to leave the world a better place. Maybe this time, we could not leave all that behind as soon as the threat is over. If we forget, well, there's always the good place. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audio engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.